Welcome to the Strategy Driven Podcast, Responsibility Driven Leadership. On behalf of the entire Strategy Driven team, I would like to welcome you to this edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast, Responsibility Driven Leadership. The Strategy Driven Podcast focuses on the tools and techniques executives and managers can use to improve their organization's alignment and accountability to ultimately achieve superior results. These podcasts elaborate on the best practice and warning flag articles found on the Strategy Driven website at www.strategydriven.com. In this episode, Emmett Murphy, Chair of Murphy Leadership, shares with us his insights on responsibility-driven leadership. Now more than ever, people seek leaders who see beyond their own needs, who have vision and integrity, who inspire trust, and who encourage and develop their employees. They want leaders who not only ensure their own success, but that of the organization as well. In other words, people want leaders who are responsibility-driven. And so now, without any further delays, let's get started. We are privileged to be joined by Emmett Murphy, Chair of Murphy Leadership, a leadership development consultancy providing dynamic programs, products, and services that have yielded remarkable results at companies such as IBM, AT&T, Xerox, and McDonald's. He is the author of the New York Times business bestseller, Leadership IQ, the recently released Talent IQ, and the upcoming book, The Responsibility-Driven Leader. Dr. Murphy has held faculty, administrative, and consulting positions with the State University of New York, the American Management Association, Booz Allen Hamilton, and the London University, among others. Emmett, welcome to the Strategy Driven Podcast.
Well, thank you, Nathan. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you on the show, and I'm really looking forward to learning more about responsibility-driven leadership. Now, Emmett, I understand your work on responsibility-driven leadership is founded on the study of thousands of managers at organizations large and small throughout the world. So to start our conversation, would you tell us a little bit about your research and how you were able to identify the qualities of great leadership?
Certainly, Nathan. That's a pleasure. This has been an ongoing study now, launched some 20-some-odd years ago when, we were beset by questions regarding, what really works and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. As we entered what we'll call the one of the early ages of the guru, where we had many books and many opinions on what great leadership was, and we as a firm concluded that we really needed a scientific approach to this, evidence-based, insight. We were also a firm that was very much into research and required by our clients to undertake heavy fiduciary responsibilities, and we were involved in healthcare with such a very evidence-based environment as well. So we began, and I tell you, the simplest way was we were a bunch of psychologists and psychiatrists, physicians, and others, and thus we all had our biases in terms of testing and so forth. We learned that most of that just didn't work. It wasn't effective as predictors of things. So, for example, okay, if you do the MMPI or some other personality inventory, it mm-hmm. might be useful in court, but it's not on a practical level terribly useful. What we did find was, as we began to get into this, that when you ask the question, who would you entrust with your life savings? What manager? Who would you entrust with your mother or father's life if you had to put them on the unit managed by a certain person?
Sure.
People would pick certain people. And we began to say, well, let's see if they are, why would you have picked that person? Well, we found as we did that, that first we learned in looking at the way they manage their client or customer or patient relationships, that the customers had a much higher level of satisfaction and reciprocity and commitment to the organization and to the team that was working under that manager. The second thing we learned was, from a financial point of view, the results were so much better. Mm-hmm. We learned that over time, over 2, 3, 4, 5 years of tracking those managers, we saw that the results were consistent rather than a flash in the pan. And so then we, as a result of that, started to ask the question, how do these people actually live their lives on the job? That led us to uncover what we call certain core guiding principles, might be called personality traits or qualities as well, but they were number seven, and they were very, very specific and concrete. And it also led to a very clear delineation of which skills. There are thousands of things a manager or leader can do, but only some of them really count. And so we're able to delineate those, and that really led us to understand what we'll call the chicken and egg routine between the skills and the values. You can have the values. If you don't have the skills, you don't get anything done. If you don't have the skills, you can't implement the values. And so we began to understand that relationship and be able to document it. Leadership IQ is an early documentation of it. Talent IQ, et cetera, and now responsibility-driven leadership. And to comment now, the specific subject base is now over 27,000 leaders in 982 different organizations, and they really represent the world, and from very entrepreneurial to very established, large, Fortune 100, also very small, and then also in healthcare and in not-for-profit environments, not a lot in the government. We do have quite a few, I take that back, we have quite a few leaders in the government, but mm-hmm. when we identified the most exceptional, I'm afraid we did not have many in government.
Okay. Well, that is phenomenal. And it really makes your study universally applicable.
Well, it is broad-gauged. It is very broad-gauged. We've had wonderful cooperation from colleagues, some at MIT, at the American Management Associations, and several other places who have really made it very possible for us to make this broadcast. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Emmett, before we delve into responsibility-driven leadership, I'd like to ask a question that I get asked often.
Sure.
And that is, what would you call or describe as being the difference between responsibility and accountability?
One is intrinsic. One is extrinsic. One is imposed from outside. Accountability is something people perceive others doing to others. So you must be accountable to this standard from the government, this regulation, this company policy, this goal, this target, this objective. And the individual involved in being accountable receives that information as an imposition from outside. They may agree, they may sign a contract to that effect, they may say, okay, I'll do it. But it is perceived to be outside, imposed from outside. So an accountability issue in our culture is one not considered to be owned and developed by the individual, but to be imposed. Responsibility is that which flows from an intrinsic motivation. I believe I should own this challenge, this problem, this opportunity, this goal. This criticism is valid. I should own it. I need to improve. I get it. It's mine. So it's a function of ownership, and in that respect is a very clear demarcation between the two. And when you go into organizations, it becomes very clear very quickly whether it's an accountability-driven environment or a responsibility-driven environment. And the results are dramatically different. If you're in a clinical environment, in a critical care unit, mortality and morbidity is higher in accountability-driven environments. And if you're in an automobile manufacturing operation, you're going to have a lot more mistakes and lemons produced in an accountability environment. So that's the difference.
That's the difference. And I had never thought of that before, but I guess that really speaks to why it's responsibility-driven leadership, because only the person can drive what is within them. It wouldn't be accountability-driven leadership. It's kind of accountability-opposed or imposed leadership.
And to your point, Nathan, this is a culture and a growing culture that's spreading worldwide. What's we all need to understand, those of us who are very U.S.-oriented, need to understand, is that the world is moving towards an international standard that is more pluralistic. We won't call it just American. It's pluralistic, meaning the individual counts. And in that environment, the individual must be responsible. One of our clients is the World Cargo Alliance, the world's largest alliance of people. 95%+ of all the world's trade goes through the hands of these folks.
Mm-hmm.
And hundreds of millions of dollars are floating around every day, and they are on, you know, somebody's word, somebody's personal check, somebody's et cetera. And, you know, responsibility is what drives people from Turkey to Abyssinia to, you know, to New York and Minneapolis. And so you really see the difference. And empirically, the people, the 4,000 members of this who drive the world straight in many ways, you know, they know. They know who to trust, who will own the situation and who will not. And the results, of course, are dramatically different. Those who own it do very well. Those who do not, do not.
Well, Emmett, we've talked a lot about responsibility-driven leadership. I was wondering, do you have a definition of what you mean by responsibility-driven leadership? And then what are some of the specific qualities that a responsibility-driven leader necessarily possesses?
They are one and the same, so let me approach it. We find that there are responsibility-driven leadership is a construct of seven specific qualities that get translated into some very, and I'll mention the most specific roles. The qualities are, first, a life decision to get ahead through achievement. You can get ahead many ways. You can get ahead coercively, trying to be a bully. You can get ahead by riding your daddy's coattails to the country club. Or you can get ahead by saying, I'm going to learn something, I'm going to do something, this is what I do, and this is who I am. We found that the responsibility-driven people are first and foremost achievers. Secondly, they are pragmatic. They're not ideologues. When they work with someone, they really are looking for a pragmatic solution. You know, I'm reminded here of a person like Andy Grove. I mean, he's just driven to find how it works. And he's not, you know, compelled by some kind of ideological point of view. He wants to know what works. And that leads to the third thing. We call it strategic humility. These are strong-willed people, but they seem to stop on a dime when they don't know something. And they say, you know, I don't know it. I don't understand what you're talking about.
Okay.
You know, please educate me. One of my favorites in this regard is a fellow we don't hear enough from recently is Lee Iacocca, a very wonderful, charismatic character, and so you think he's a perpetual talker. Well, no. When he's in a group meeting, boy, he's as disciplined and says, I don't know what you know, and I am determined to find out what you know. And I think of him as a classic example of a person strong-willed who strategically humble, knows what he doesn't know.
Okay.
The fourth characteristic is really fascinating, and that is partnership. A wonderful woman named Marlise Simuni, who is the CEO of the world's largest healthcare consulting organization, people are partners or not partners, and whether they're patients, whether they're colleagues, the relationship has to be one of true reciprocity. And she envisions the people she's serving as the most important people in her relationship. Now, I know it's, when we say this in the workplace, that, you know, it's very important, the customer is important, and then we turn around and we act like, you know, we're important to each other. She's a woman who makes it very clear, without a patient, without a client, there is no thing called a hospital. There is no thing called a business. There is no thing called, you know, stock value and shareholder wealth.
Sure.
And so, you know, she really translates that well. I'm old enough, you know, when I was a very young guy, I worked with Sam Walton, who used to talk about the customer as a fellow citizen, as a partner in society. And I really believe we're going to have to get back to that. Certainly, the people we've observed who are most effective get that. And that, in turn, fuels what we call commitment. People don't drop the ball. They actually get the job done. That fuels optimism. One of the things that Martin Seligman, the great psychologist, points out is that hope and optimism are learned traits.
Oh, okay.
You might be born melancholic a little bit, you know, and a little bit this way and that way, euphoric, but true optimism and hope is learned through bouncing off the walls of life and picking yourself up and saying, hey, you know what? The only real alternative is to believe I can do something. And so hopeful people are people who've gone through the achievement, pragmatism, humility, partnership, and commitment phases, become hopeful. And when they become hopeful, they say, you know, this life, warts and all, is mine. I'm proud of it. I own it. The decisions I've made, I own. And what's going to happen next, I own. My mistakes, I owned. I am responsible. So responsibility is made up of that ownership that comes from achievement, pragmatism, humility, partnership, commitment, and optimism. What we've learned is that there are certain core skills that people who are truly responsible practice exceedingly well. One is selection. We have a lot of very fashionable ways to select in our world, but you know, these guys come out of the what did you do counts more than what you say, and they focus on what people have actually done in their lives. We've also noticed, and they're very specific scripts for it, we've also noticed that when it comes to issues of conflict, they don't let it fester. They realize that it's both risk and potential energy, and they intervene quickly and directly themselves. They don't delegate it. They're not afraid to move forward personally and lead from the front lines. And things like conflict, you see this. Too often we see people who really get all up in the levels and all up in the executive suites. And we had a wonderful example of that when we were opening a hospital in Rome. It was a joint venture with the Vatican. And I was walking around with the fellow representing the Vatican Bank, the owner, the partner, and he was upstairs with me, an older fellow, and he was flushing the toilets, making sure the plumbing works while we were waiting for the Pope to arrive to bless the place. And the American executive's downstairs in his $5,000 suit waiting very properly. Meanwhile, this other guy's upstairs flushing the toilets, and he wasn't afraid to make sure the place worked. And
sure.
He was one of those kind of people who, you know, just gets it that, you know, he led from the front. He didn't lead from the office with his fancy suits on.
Mm-hmm.
And we've learned those kind of things. We've learned that negotiation, for example, we use all this win-win jargon in our stuff. We learned that that's really not terribly relevant. We found that negotiation is essentially a problem-solving session where if the other person wins and you win, very often the customer loses. I mean, think the UAW and the automobile industry is a great example of that. They both cut each other good deals, but in the process they forgot about who the hell pays the bills.
Yeah.
So we've learned that the skill sets of these people are very sharply defined, very focused on taking direct action in the front lines of work. Does that help?
That helps a lot. Thank you. And I want to bring it to today because, you know, I know a lot, well, we and a lot of our listeners are challenged by the economic conditions of today's marketplace. We haven't gone through a recessionary period, certainly on a global scale like this in quite some time. And so what I think a lot of people are probably wondering right now is what's the unique value that responsibility-driven leadership is going to provide to them and their organizations that in this economic time of difficulty will help them both survive, but more so they want to thrive and make it through this period.
Yeah. Responsibility is the heart of entrepreneurial IQ. A concurrent project in this, we just couldn't help but recognize that the common factor, we found this emerging through the data and everything else, and, sometimes we really feel very, very dumb. When, the evidence comes up and a lot of our researchers working with it say, when you look at those people who own their own business, and then you look at this person over here, you look at, Dr. Grove, and you look at the people in Mr. Buffett's operation, and then you look over here, they act just like the people who own the business. And yet, at the same time, in this other corporation, everything's by a big, procedure, protocol, and the way they run their teams have 30 things they got to check on before they can get anything done. And we realized that the essence of the economic culture of the Americas, of the U.S. and to a great extent Canada, its private sector, is that entrepreneurialism, which at the center point of it is, I am responsible, I will take charge, I will provide this service, I will see that it gets done, and I will expect to be rewarded appropriately. And we're seeing that this crosses over, that the responsibility thing is the essence of the entrepreneurial spirit, and concurrently we have undertaken a whole project that has grown out of the responsibility leader thing, which is entrepreneurial IQ. What does it take to be an entrepreneur? What does it take to take charge of your own economic future, go into your own business, or if you're working in a corporation, how to turn that corporation from a reactionary, accountability-driven culture to an entrepreneurial culture, a responsibility-driven culture. So the bottom line, the answer to your question is this. The people who are going to survive and come out of this more strong are those who develop the responsibility / entrepreneurial skill set that has come out of this research. And therefore, that is one reason why, we will find in the next few months we publish responsibility-driven leadership, and also concurrently, I didn't want to just get carried away too far here, we are publishing also entrepreneurial IQ as an actual integrated training system for, especially for people who are professionals who wonder, how do I really get out there and start things? Because we're moving more and more to a virtual world where people are identified by their personal skills portfolios, by their achievement and responsibility, and that is the essence of being an entrepreneur and being in your own business. And even if you're in a large corporation like IBM today,
sure,
their whole computer operation is driven by an entrepreneurial ethos, where everybody's bidding on jobs, bidding on things. A team process we did with Hewlett-Packard back years ago, about 10 years ago, there people bid on the teams, and they had to bring their portfolios and how they took initiative, and rather than being passive and reactive. And the entrepreneurial spirit is very much present in that Hewlett-Packard environment, very formally so. So I think that to survive, you've got to be responsible / entrepreneurial.
Okay. As you were describing that, something came to mind, and years ago I had worked with an organization, and they had a lot of employees that made six figures that just to take a trip to go to a town, say a two-hour drive down the road, they had to go up the, quote, chain of command to get authorization to do that, even though the chain of command was the one that assigned the trip. They had to go all through all these sign-offs. And they come back and they would write a trip report, and it had to be signed by a vice president. And this was just something that got internally filed.
Yeah, it's the naked ape piddling in the corners territorial stuff that goes on when a business or enterprise gets flush enough that those at the top are either replaced second generation, third generation, or lost their zeal. And usually what happens is at the top's lonely, so the top people hire bodyguards, otherwise known as vice presidents. The vice presidents hire their bodyguards, otherwise known as directors, senior directors. And when you look at the history of an organization that has gotten very wasteful and obese, if you will,
yes,
you see that it grew fat at the top, and then it was filled in underneath as bodyguards were added, and people basically, if you don't go up the chain of command in their particular silos, then they have no purpose in life other than being bodyguards. So the more wasteful the organization, the more you'll find that people up the ladder are insistent that they must sign off. Only they can decide on this or that. And the reason is they have nothing else to do. And they're there largely because they're waste. And as you can see in our work, we're not called upon to be subtle about these things. This is the way it is. This is the anthropological history of organizations and of our peoples. That's how empires fail, and that's how organizations fail.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you, you nailed that organization to a T, and I'm not going to, of course, name their name, but down to the job titles. Because they call them vice presidents, and they have senior vice presidents, and they have directors, and it's just that level, and you go, why does this vice president have one person reporting to either him or her, and it's another vice president?
Yeah, well, you got to have somebody to have coffee with who has a title, right?
Yeah.
Come on. Yeah, there's an empathy there. I mean, it's lonely. You don't want to go to have coffee with somebody who doesn't have a real executive title.
Well, not that's true, too.
Yeah.
Well, Emmett, for those organizations that want to move forward and build a culture of responsibility-driven leadership, how do they foster that kind of culture, that kind of presence amongst their executives, managers, and employees?
Well, they ask the question, the first thing they do actually is ask the question, to what extent do we resemble this pattern that has been identified and I've spoken to? There are many ways to do that, discussion, assessments, which we have, and so forth. The second thing is you actually put an issue on the line, like how do we select people around here? Actually look at the practice.
Ah, okay.
And how did these people come in here? How were they selected? How effective has our selection been? Another issue is how well aligned are our people? Let me give you an example. We had a venture with GE years back, and we created a system called work-life mapping, where we look at what people actually do, the work they actually do. We applied this to healthcare, for example. I have over 500,000 doctors, nurses, custodians, inventory people, guards, ambulance drivers, executives, presidents, and deans. We found that the average physician in a family in a faculty practice in a university is spending 55% of his or her time doing the wrong stuff, not seeing patients. Recently, at a study we did with the world's leading totally integrated organization, we found that the physicians were doing all the work of clerks and nurses, and their productivity was 30% of benchmark.
Oh, wow.
We found that nurses are doing 44% nationwide doing the wrong work. We find that when you get into situations like banks, it's not uncommon to find your executives actually not generating any revenue or actually seeing customers or involved in anything that has material benefit to the shareholders. We find that when you look at key jobs, you'll find that alignment is way out. People, we said we've hired these people to do these things, and yet they're not actually doing them. And the reason is we've gotten sloppy and wasteful. So there are three major ways that we see that you can really tackle this issue. One is do an assessment. Compare yourself and your own attributes and so forth and see how you line up as compared to people who really have ended up being the benchmark people in this study. Secondly, look at key skills and how they are performed within your organization vis-a-vis how these other folks perform them, the benchmark people perform them. And the third thing is a very key tip-off is, are the right people in the right place doing the right work at the right time? And cost. I mean, for example, the most wasteful work doesn't come from secretaries, custodians. It comes from paying executives to do custodian work or secretary work. So, you know, it's a very, it requires some truth-telling. And mm-hmm. But truth-telling doesn't work. You could be telling the truth in gossip. It doesn't do any good. You've got to actually look hard at behaviors that make a difference for the customer, make a difference for your partners. And that's how we suggest people do it.
Sure. Oh, that's great. And, you know, it brings me back to that example company again. They eliminated a lot of their administrative staff, and then they transferred it to their technical staff. And so just like in the case of the doctors you mentioned, you know, they had these very highly paid technical people that were spending at a minimum 20% of their time, some 100% of their time doing administrative tasks that really should have been performed by somebody else.
Well, and that's an interesting point. In some organizations we go because you get this contamination where people aren't, they're doing hybrid jobs that really are not very well focused, you get a dumbing down effect. When technical people, for example, are doing the wrong work, they become addicted to the non-technical work. And in the process, their concentration is taken from their technical skills or their professional skills. Lawyers are a good example of this.
Mm-hmm.
Surgeons who get caught up in doing other stuff in surgery. That gets a little scary with lawyer and so forth, you know.
You're expecting
professional work. They're doing non-professional work. They become more addicted to the non-professional work. Their focus on their professional work declines. Their competency declines, and you get a dumbing down of professionals as they spend their time on the wrong things. Now, to the other point, the same thing happens with managers. It's very much like being a pianist or an athlete. If you don't practice, you don't do it well. So managers who are not really managing, caught in between in various roles, tend not to be skillful enough because it's more easy to fill out a report or answer all the emails. God knows there are 200-300 a day for some of these folks.
Yes.
So, you know, so the thing about it is we've got to really ask ourselves, why are we here? You know, I often say that it really comes down to the Irish, Italian, Jewish, Muslim mother's question. You know, what are you doing with your life on the job? Or what are you doing with your life, period?
Mm-hmm.
And so many of us know we go to work and really aren't doing things that are meaningful. And it really causes us tremendous stress. Studies of 15,000 nurses in Canada show that it's the single greatest predictor of major, major illness is not doing the right work.
Okay.
Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
Yeah.
But I can fully understand I've always called it losing the edge.
Yeah, well, you do. Yeah, usually it comes when you're just not doing, you know, what you're doing. I mean, obviously, for example, you're right here guiding me through this. It's not delegated someplace else. There are some things we should not be delegating.
Mm-hmm.
We're becoming a world of surrogates, and the people we found who are great leaders, they don't find this. I mean, they delegate enough to make sure they have the time to be leaders.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Emmett, before we close tonight, I did want to ask you about one other thing, and that is you have a website, which is www.murphyleadership.com, and I spent a couple hours on it this past week. Phenomenal website. I really enjoyed all the resources you had there. And I was wondering if you would tell our listeners just a little bit about the website and the resources that they can find.
Certainly. We try to provide a lot of intellectual resources in the way of information on different skills, different things, our research. We try to make it all available. It comes under the heading that we were advised years back, you know, share 70% of what little you know, and the world will pay you back adequately through the other 30%. And we try to run the company based on a real partnership model of sharing. So one of the things we do is try to make sure the website has a broad array of information that our clients have found very useful. And we want to share that. The second thing is that hopefully Through LinkedIn and Facebook, we begin to become more conversational. We will begin a major social networking dialogue where we have open forums on responsibility-driven leadership, on entrepreneurial IQ. So we really want to hear from people and discuss things. So we try to be interactive in that regard and hope people will pay a visit and let us know who they are.
Well, I certainly hope so. Like I said before, I loved your website and got a lot of benefit out of it. Well, Emmett, before we close, I want to thank you, not only for your time, but for sharing your insights with me and our audience on responsibility-driven leadership. I've thoroughly enjoyed our discussion this evening and hope our listeners will take the time to visit your website in order to learn more about responsibility-driven leadership. But more to the point, I hope that they will take what they learn and then apply it within their own organizations, because I know that they will be more successful and they'll get a lot better results by doing so. So thank you again for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast. I would like to personally thank Emmett Murphy for being with us today and sharing his insights on responsibility-driven leadership. As always, we would appreciate receiving your feedback by email at podcast@strategydriven.com. If you enjoyed the show, please consider voting for us on Podcast Alley and visiting our website at www.strategydriven.com. You can find more information about Emmett Murphy and responsibility-driven leadership at www.murphyleadership.com. Until next time, so long.